Well, hey there, Skips and Skipperettes from across the internet, and welcome back to Tales from the Jungle Cruise. You know, I always like when I get to sit down and tape a serious podcast and really dig into the history of the jungle and of Disneyland. Tonight, Skip may have only been on the rivers for 6 months, but he spent over a decade in the halls of Imagineering, and I wanted to get a perspective from behind the curtain and see what he had to say. Now, before we get to the fun stuff, a couple quick plugs. Hey, we're on Stitcher Radio now. Join us there on your iPhone or Android smartphone, and from your browser as well. Now, you can still find us at Jungle Cruise, JungleCrews, .podbean.com, and we just had a revamp of our website over there, or over on iTunes at Skipcast. You can search either Jungle Cruise or Skipcast over there. We also love to get the feedback about what you like or don't like, so please email us at JungleCrews, C-R-E-W-S, at gmail.com. Now, sadly, we had less than fantastic audio conditions, so my apologies for the first third or so of this podcast. But we had a great sit-down chat, so please join me in welcoming Skipper Ron Robledo to the Jungle Cruise. Because I'm casual with this whole, like, starting thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think starting is for wimps and people who don't, you know, have podcasts. Hey, everyone. Tales from the Jungle Cruise, Season 2, Episode something rather. I need to quit labeling them because then production things get in the way and I flip the numbers. And people get really, really, like, confused about what we're doing. So, sitting down tonight, Ron
Robledo.
Robledo. Yeah. Jungle Cruise skipper, when were you at the Happy Resort?
Oh my gosh. I started Imagineering in 89, so it was probably a year before that or thereabouts.
Okay.
Yeah, so I was a graphic artist elsewhere and did the Jungle Cruise kind of for fun and preparation for trying to prep myself for stand up.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. And so how long were you, about a year-ish on the ride?
Oh, God, no.
And how long were you? Because I was there on and off for 8 years, sometimes more off than on. The people who work with me say I was off on a regular basis. So how long were you?
If I said it was 6 months, it got tired for me pretty quick.
Yeah.
But I loved it, and I still have fond memories. But again, working a full-time job elsewhere and then going over there for what was kind of a fun thing for me.
Sure. Yeah. Now, did you, we'll get around to the whole you and art thing, which is the one of the main reasons I wanted to have you on is because of some of your side projects. Now, was your intention that you wanted to go and do Imagineering? Was it the graphic side of thing? Were you doing that back then?
Oh, I was. Yeah, I've been doing that forever. It just kind of happened. I had a friend who worked at Imagineering. She told me about a position that was opened, a graphic position. It was a few months after I had quit Jungle Cruise, and they had a wonderful letter of recommendation for me when I left, and used that and got myself in at Imagineering, like I said, back in 89.
Cool.
Yeah. And before any Imagineer had a Macintosh computer. In fact, I think I was the first one at Imagineering with a Macintosh computer.
That's scary because I remember, see, 89, that would have been coming up into, that would have been after the Apple IIc era. Yeah. So, yeah, you're coming right into like one of the first actual true Macintoshes. That's terrible. So, obviously, it was all pen and paper back in those days.
Oh, yeah, it was ridiculous. Ruby lifts and just paste up and lead. It was a lot of fun.
Something I haven't talked about in the podcast, my first Disney experience was working with Imagineering. They were doing the Autopia move, with the whole reconfiguration and with Chevron as the corporate sponsor. And I actually went in there. I was regional manager for a textile company. And we did all of the outdoor green AstroTurf that was there around Autopia. So I got to go backstage and, you know, talk to the guys and do specifications and all of that wonderful stuff. I think that's when I got the Disney bug.
Hmm.
And then ended up, you know, working on my side too. So just to bring the listener side up to speed, we're kind of in an indefinite... we're starting recording just to chat. We've got one other ex-skipper joining us at some point, so we'll just throw him into the mix when he gets here, and he'll just have to pick up and run with it. So what? So when you went through the casting process, if that was, you know, that late 80s thing, it was pretty much just toss you where they will at the time? I mean,
I think so, because yeah. I remember going in for the interview. I think I had a little bit of facial hair, and they said, that's got to go. And I think they said I needed to get a haircut as well. But my thing was, I told them I'd like to work the Jungle Cruise. And I said, but if I don't get that, then anything else would be fine, which was a lie. If I wasn't going to get it, I wasn't going to work there.
Yeah.
But fortunately, I got to work there. One of my first experiences was with Chris.
He'll be here eventually. Well, and it is, you know, it's interesting because it actually segues into, by the way, I love how the timing of this, every loud car has gone by since we started recording. It was dead silent before we got out here. It was so peaceful and relaxed and tranquil, and now it's road races out here in Pasadena right next to the microphone. So, well, you know, on the stand-up comedy side of things, you know, one of the things I saw out of the generation that I was at Jungle with, you know, there was they do a stand-up show, a skipper stand-up show, probably four times a year, wow. Five times a year down at the Maverick Theater down in Fullerton. And I think those have kind of been on hold, but I know that there's a big 2013 return plan.
Oh, wow.
But I want to say that they probably had a dozen or so shows with Jungle Cruise skippers doing stand-up work. I did all my stand-up way before. I did mine in 92, 93, 94 was more my stand-up out of Seattle, Portland, San Francisco. So it was more, you know, I had that early, and then when I came to Disney, I already had that experience.
Oh, nice.
And it was strange, because coming from that viewpoint, I already knew how to butcher a joke, and I didn't have to have the Disney training and how badly to do that. And if you ask anyone who worked with me, I knew how to slay him with the best. So, but no, it's a good training ground because you quit being afraid.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I just... In fact, at one point in time, after numerous trips around, I actually had Tom Hanks on my boat.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, for me, I'm sure for yourself as well, his timing is just ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. And that was... Bosom Buddy days.
No, I think it was a little after. I think it was right around
Big?
Maybe around Big. Yeah, I think it was. Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, and I dug him on Bosom Buddies, and then when he started getting big, and then seeing him on my boat, you know, those microphones echoed, so you could hear the cotton mouth actually starting to form when he was on there. But he was very gracious when he was done. He came over and you know, introduced himself and complimented me, and you know, and for me it was, you know, a wonderful memory. He comes up to me and said, hey, just wanted to compliment you on your timing. Said the jokes here are a little bit stale, but your timing was really good. And I was just, you know, I was in awe. I looked at him and I said, I love you.
Yeah.
I really didn't say that, but, and his wife came over. It was a wonderful experience.
Yeah, you know, and he really, I mean, he deserves the nicest man in Hollywood reputation he's got. If any of you are Tom Hanks fans, I always like to try to cross promote podcasts that don't need any promotion, because they're getting, you know, 500,000 hits an episode already. But the Nerdist podcast, Chris Hardwick and Matt Myra, Jonah Ray, had a fantastic interview with Tom Hanks. Probably the best single interview that I've heard with him. And, you know, it was a little... I mean, obviously, they're fans of his. But he's a giant nerd. I think he has, you know, a monster typewriter collection. I mean, just like strange, bizarre things. So, no, he... the Tom Hanks interview, one of the best interviews on the Nerdist side of things. Yeah, I think we all have our celebrity moments that we get to have. You know, I think that things have changed, you know, in the time since, where now the celebrities, there's so much exposure on TMZ and all of those other things that are out there that, you know, you definitely they can't come into the park because everyone would know who they are. So that they have to be, you know, shielded with plaids and with guest relations people making sure they're getting treated right. And it's not like it used to be where you could just have people come into to Disneyland. You know, it's become too much of a media juggernaut. So how long did you stand up for?
Not long, really. I enjoyed it, found out that I wasn't really that good at it. Had a blast doing it, and you do feed, I mean, you know, you have your A material and your B and your filler material, and it was kind of upsetting. You would think you'd have good A material, and you'd tell the joke, and it would bomb. Maybe it was the audience, maybe it wasn't my material. And then you'd have the B and the filler, and they would laugh at that, and I remember getting a little bit upset and thinking, that was like filler material, why are you laughing at this? This was the... You know, I still get the bug every now and then, and still write a little bit and still think, maybe for fun I'll go back and do it a little bit. Talk to an old Jungle Cruise skipper, Rob Dewberry, from time to time, who did a bit himself and actually was writing, I think as recently as about a year ago, with Dana Carvey, before Rob moved to the East Coast. But, so I'd still chat with him and have fun with that.
There's a really good open mic night on Sundays at Meltdown Comics in L.A. That's if you ever get the bug and want to just go try out material, 3 minutes, you know, try your stuff out. It's, you know, room full of comics. And if you just want to go and, you know, catch some good comedy for, you know, for a dirt cheap price of, I don't think they charge for it, but that's become a really good, amazing venue for comedy in L.A., excuse me, but yeah, it's up on Sunset Boulevard, and they have a huge back room that's just devoted to shows.
Oh, wow.
And they have great comics that come, and big names. It isn't just small stuff. They're getting Laugh Factory quality comics just dropping by to try material out, or they'll have shows, you know, set up. I mean, Dave Chappelle has been there.
Wow.
I mean, just major names just come by and work out material.
Huh. And how long did you do it?
I did about 3.5 years. I toured, I would say about a year and a half or so, where I did a lot. I got my start at home. And the dangers of Pasadena. Things that will be edited out. I actually got my start doing improv. And was teaching, this is one of those like joke material levels. I was teaching inner city kids how to do improv theater.
Wow.
Where we would go into really urban areas and teach them how to do improv. And then I started doing the stand-up thing. As I would go and teach improv, I would do stand-up in the clubs in whatever town that I was in. So I did probably, I don't know, 50, 60 sets over 2 years.
Wow.
So
when's the last time you've done it, or
I still get the bug. I still get the bug. I still write material. It's mainly because I went through a really bad breakup last December, so I have tons of new material. I actually know comedians who get involved in like 6 or 8 month good, deep relationships just to break up with them, so they can have really good bitterness. Because we all know that, you know, falling in love is a lot like drinking Drano. It you get warm and tingly for a while, but in the end, it just leaves you hollow on the inside. It's sad because it's true. So, yeah, no, it was a good bug. I have a hard time with it now because I've been out of it for so long that, you know, doing Jungle for I was at the resort, I think 6 years I was at Jungle, on and off, with a couple breaks in there. But when you're doing Jungle, it kind of, you know, helps. It's like methadone for stand-up comedians. You know, it just kind of, you know, weans you off the drug and the need for it. And then you're off for a while and you have to go back and do it again. I still wish, and we said this about a million times on the podcast, is I wish we'd go back and do single days. Like, I would do, like, 1 day a month, volunteer without pay, just to work the ride again.
Wow.
You know, and there's a lot of skippers that are that same way, where they would just happily just take that 1 day and just, you know, sit and chat about it and jump on the boat and jump in a costume and do it for free.
It was the same way when I worked at Imagineering for the Christmas family night. They would want volunteers to go and work the Jungle Cruise. And I would ask, like, no, we already have our fill. We don't. And it's like, all right, fine. It's like, you know, I've done it. I would love to be able to go back. And I wanted to desperately.
Yeah.
And then, like I said, I think the last year that I was there, they said, hey, well, we need you now to, if you wanted to go back and do the Jungle Cruise. Like, no, this is my last year here at Imagineering. I want to be here with my family. Bad breaks, but I would have loved to have gone back.
Now, what did you do on the Imagineering side? Because we have a couple other Imagineers who were skippers that were recently with Imagineering that we're going to sit down with in a couple weeks, actually. So what did you do while you were there?
I wore a lot of hats, everything from running the training department to working with the graphics department to even being able to help out on a couple of attractions, the many adventures of Winnie the Pooh. I got to start out from the ground level on that, which was an absolute blast. You know, and again, I'm doing a lot of art there, you know, graphic stuff. But when I actually got to go and sit in a room and pitch my ideas for the Winnie the Pooh attraction, I'm looking around and I'm pitching and thinking, don't I need to be back in my office working or something? And it kind of dawned on me, like, you know, son of a gun, I am actually here working. This is work.
Yeah.
That was absolutely phenomenal to get paid to do something like that. And again, I mean, just working for Imagineering for the 14 years that I was there, wow, that's a long time.
So you actually, I mean, we may have had crossover, because that was, you were there when they were doing the redesign for Autopia.
Oh, yeah.
So you would have known all about those things. So so one of the projects, and it's always, you know, it's the thing about Imagineering is that there's a million different concepts, and of, you know, of the 100 concepts that are, you know, developed, you may have a couple that actually make it to actual execution. Did you see the whole Villain's Lair thing that they were talking about for a while? The concept to take on Six Flags and have all the big coasters?
No, I didn't. That doesn't even ring a bell.
I think it was supposed to go into Orlando, and then they ended up not doing it, and they ended up doing Wild Animal Kingdom.
I know they had talked about doing some gaming with a similar concept.
Yeah.
But one of the other things, you know, being on the Jungle Cruise, is the original concept for the Indiana Jones attraction was ridiculous. Oh my gosh.
Oh, yeah, the boat's going through the ride.
Yeah,
the
it was just phenomenal. I remember sitting in one of the meetings and just thinking, this is going to be the greatest attraction ever. And as large as Indy is now, they absolutely toned it down quite a bit. Yeah.
Well, including, you know, there's the room that budgets deny. There's the black spot about two-thirds of the way through the ride. You actually idle the car.
Right.
And then it's that dark room where the, you know, that was where they ran out of money for it. But apparently they're putting some more show elements into Indy this next year.
Oh, really?
So that's what I've heard. I don't know for 100%, but I've heard that there's some plans to put in some additional show elements in the ride. I remember the opening with the ice machines that were very quickly, as you went into the Mara room, it was the falling ice, and they had the ice machines that would cycle and throw out the giant ice cube blocks coming down.
Wow, no, I...
And then it would melt. Those operated maybe for 6 months, and then they functionally just, you know, didn't work, and they gave up on them.
I remember going close to the opening day to that attraction. I don't remember that.
It was, the opening day was weird for me, because it was, I was on my honeymoon, I want to say, coming down from Washington State before I'd even gotten the Disney bug. So I hadn't even moved to California yet. We had come down, and it was a month or so before. So we were there for the soft open of it, and still have my AT&T decoder cards and all that fun stuff.
Oh, geez, yeah.
So there's a couple of cast members who've reprinted the dictionary, so people can go through and find it. So sorry, I keep on watching the background levels to see how bad this is going to be to edit. We're in a little place called Zephyr Cafe in Pasadena, which I was told was a quiet little hamlet with hardly anyone. And
I don't know who said that.
Yeah, it is a rough... Well, actually, the waitress, when I called to say, hey, is there any music in the background? She's like, no, it's quiet here usually. Liar, lying liars. But it also, because my microphone picks up everything. We'll cut all this boring crap out. This is the stuff I take right out. So what projects were you involved with on the Imagineering side that you wanted to see happen or that you had interest in that just never went anywhere? Was there anything that you went, that was the greatest idea?
No, I was thrilled to see Indy. I think when I first started... is when they first started doing Toontown, and I remember looking at some of it and the way that they were developing some of the buildings and like the trolley cars with the
the bounce,
oval
the
shape
roll,
tires, and thinking you got to be kidding me, that you cannot do that, you know, me doubting Thomas very young back then. And then seeing it come to fruition and just being absolutely amazed. It was just, it was wonderful. Like I said, I was there for 14 years and I kind of felt like they were paying me to go to school. It's just a phenomenal place to work, wonderful people. I still have a lot of friends that I talk to almost weekly.
Do you remember when we were talking about Toontown, when the Roger Rabbit lines wrapped all the way out of Toontown going out into Fantasyland when it opened? It would go all.
Oh my gosh!
It would go all the way, because Roger Rabbit, besides having, I think arguably the best queue that they had done to the time. I think that was when we first started seeing these amazingly themed queues,
right?
Because that queue is still gorgeous, even for a movie that, you know, I don't think is as remembered as it should be in the Disney archives. But that queue area where they load you in is gorgeous. And there's puns everywhere. There's, you know, clever references to the movies and the weasels. And, I mean, it's a beautifully... The queue is part of the ride. And Disney had always done that, but not on that level. Hmm. I think that was where it really blew up. And then the indie queue, you know, is great. You know, they really have done a lot more with the queuing process. But I think that's where it started. I think that's where it really erupted personally. It was seeing Roger. So I'm sorry. So other project-y stuff?
Again, I mean,
everything.
Yeah, I mean, I got to participate on you know, seeing the beginning of Disney's California Adventure, which is a lot better now than when it originally started.
Yeah, you know, I was their opening crew. I was on the Malibu and the Orange Stinger. I was the first training team. Lots of buses. Let's pick that up. I was on the first training team after the opening crew. So I wasn't there for the testing or anything, but I was on Malibu and Orange Stinger. Both rides are gone now, so some people blame me. I don't know why. Just because I've trained on them, not my fault. But, you know, I went through those early years where, you know, 2 and 3 years into it, people were like, oh, it's terrible. I'm like, well, tell me a 2-year-old you like. You know, 2-year-olds have tantrums. They look cute some of the times, but they're hard to be around. It's a perfect analogy for how the park was at the time. And now that it's almost a teenager, we start liking it again.
Yeah, I will say one of the interesting things about Disney's California Adventure is when the concepts, I should say, for some of the attractions, they actually went back to the Disney archives and looked up original concept artwork for Disneyland, which was great to see that they were trying to take some of that old stuff and implement it into the new rides. I mean, even they hired some Native Americans to come in and help us because the river raft ride was going to be kind of Native American themed. And
well, they still actually did the Challenge Trail, the Redwood Creek Challenge Trail,
right,
had Native American storytelling. So there was a lot of, and I, still to this day, the story times are still there. And because Brother Bear obviously has now taken it over and influenced that whole section of it, but at the start it was very much a wilderness Yosemite Lodge kind of a feel to it. But yeah, I mean that attraction definitely had that Native American feel to it, and they really lived with that very well.
Yeah, what they were originally planned was so much different than what came out. In fact, like I said, they used to go into my department where I was running a computer lab there, and it was funny. I used to call people chief. I thought it was kind of that Jimmy Olsen thing to his boss. And then, hey, what's going on, chief? People would walk by my office. And then one time somebody walked by and said, hey, what's up, chief? And I went, shoot. And the guy turned and he looks back, and it was one of the Native American guys. I don't remember his name. They're like, what did you just say? Like, I use that term loosely to everyone. And then he started laughing. He goes, I know, I hear you say it all the time. I just thought it was funny hearing it. All right. A lot different what they ended up having than, again, some of the concept stuff.
Yeah, I think, I really think that a lot of it has held up well. I mean, now that we're, have you been down to see Cars Land?
I haven't been to Disneyland and I'm...
A dog's age.
Yeah.
Don't embarrass yourself by saying that.
Okay. In fact, my daughter was asking me recently, you need to call one of your friends because I want to go. And I told her, I said, well, I'm glad you want to go there rather than anywhere else. My daughter's going to be 19, so obviously she likes the fast rides, the attractions, and her boyfriend was saying the same thing. And I really don't like Disneyland. So, you know what, you may go to another amusement park, and it may have some fast rides, and you may enjoy the rides better. But there's something about Disneyland. Disneyland is freaking magic. You go there and you're transported. You become a kid again. I mean, say what you will about Universal Studios or any of the others, Disneyland is just magic, and I think people feel that when they're there.
I do think it's going to be interesting with, Universal is going to be opening the Harry Potter World 2015 here in L.A.
Oh, wow.
Universal. So I think that's going to change the landscape heavily. Orlando has already done, they're on their first major expansion of Harry Potter World. So I definitely see that that's going to be a huge, boon here. They're pulling the Gibson Amphitheater out. They're taking the Gibson out to make the Hogwarts Castle.
It should be interesting now that Disney's acquired Marvel to see what they're going to do with that at, I don't know if it's going to be, it'd probably be DCA.
Well, you know what? Not just Marvel, but Star Wars. I mean, that's the biggest thing with Lucas.
Oh, geez, yeah.
Is, it obviously, Star Tours, the revamp of Star Tours, last year was amazing. And they really, by putting the ride in 3D, cleaning up the queue, they revitalized that ride for, I'm sure it was a pretty penny. But, there's a huge opportunity with, Avengers and with those things. If there's ever a third park concept that makes sense now, it's going over and, pulling up the strawberry fields and parking and jumping all over a Marvel Star Wars theme park.
Yeah, I always hoped that Disney would have done something with the Incredibles and had made an Incredibles attraction.
It really didn't. I think part of that was it was early Pixar. It was relatively early. I think if there's a movie that that comes across with a need for a sequel, first of all, I don't know. They announced a Finding Nemo sequel, which if there's a movie that doesn't need a sequel, like the only movie that possibly needs a sequel less was the Liam Neeson movie Taken, which has the worst plot ever. We took his daughter. He killed a whole bunch of people. Let's just go kidnap his wife and son and see what happens. Let's up the ante, because maybe he'll be a little bit, off his game if we kidnap two of his relatives. I'm just like, really? No, they're planning a Finding Nemo 2, and they say they've got a hook for it. I just don't see that that's a movie that needs a sequel. Incredibles would almost make sense, that you do it when the kids are older or whatever. I don't see that that's one that I'm jumping up and down waiting for a Finding Nemo 2.
Yeah. They actually pitched the idea for an Incredibles attraction right before I left Imagineering. Yeah. I thought it was a pretty good concept, if I do say so myself. Deaf ears. But.
Yeah.
Wow, yeah.
But no, I think Imagineers, I think especially the guy that was my contact person, they like to brag. It was like, this was my pet project. They didn't like it. Let me tell you about it. this was what I think should have happened. But since it didn't, I'll let you know what my opinion was. So, yeah, no, it was great having that interaction on that side of things. Like, you got to see a little bit of the backstage magic, and that's what gave me the bug. One of the things that gave me the bug is, so what was your that era of Jungle?
Yeah,
was known for being a little looser with the rules. That whole late '80s, because it was before the narrations department changeovers and all that in the mid '90s when they actually did more character stuff. But no, that era, that late '80s. Was kind of known as a little bit of Wild West kind of Jungle Cruise time. It was kind of anything goes.
Yeah, I knew a few guys who would do that. And again, for me, I may have gone off spiel a little bit, but I kind of stuck to it for the most part. The worst thing that I would do is maybe, in the evenings when you have a ridiculously low number of guests on your boat.
Yep.
I'm going towards the finish of it, and I would throw out the Trader Sam joke, and if it didn't work, I would put the boat in reverse. And that alone would just surprise the heck out of people.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that they knew that it was a loud car.
Yeah, this has been a really interesting challenge on the audio side. It's all right. I'll slice out all the little bits and pieces. It's a good car, though. Those are nice. Yeah, I'm getting every splash of the water as we're hitting it. I'm actually going to pause it. All right, so we think that's going to be a much better audio quality issue. Who would imagine being right next to a street would cause you so much audio nightmares? So where were we talking about theme park? Well, let's talk. It looks like at this point we're going to be our extra person is going to be delayed, so we're just going to chat amongst ourselves. So the main reason why I kind of you showed up on my radar on the jungle side was because you were doing a Kickstarter project.
Yeah, one of the things that I've been doing lately is writing some children's books, something I've wanted to do for quite a while. Hadn't had the opportunity to do that because, you know, working a couple of jobs, having a wife and a kid tends to take...
little things like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. But I actually did my first children's book last year, and it was a blast. You know, I got to talk to a couple of agents and a couple of publishers, and I ended up self-publishing because I'm using one of my former artists. I teach at Art Center at College of Design in Pasadena, and I'm using one of my former students as the illustrator, and he's just ridiculously phenomenal for a young kid. I think he's 23 now. He's got this old man's soul in him, and the paintings are great. And the wonderful thing about this is, you know, I get to do the art directing, not a publisher hiring somebody else.
And, sure, you can have it the way you want it to be.
Yeah, in fact, it was kind of nice because one of the scenes I actually put, and you get to put your own little things in there, but there's one, it's a children's book, but there's a courtroom scene. yeah, I threw John Hench in there. John Hench is a former Imagineer, you know, worked alongside with Walt Disney. So it was kind of fun just because I used to work with him on a semi-regular basis. You know, me being a little bit of a nerd with computers back in the day when he would have problems, he would call me in and I'd go in there and help him with some stuff, whether it was like with Photoshop or whatever the case. And good grief, the guy was like 90 years old. Still painting, still driving himself in every day, using Photoshop. The guy was absolutely amazing. And never anything negative. There was, you know, nothing bad. You know, you hear about some of your heroes, and you know, for those of you who are familiar with the name John Hench, nothing negative to say. Every encounter that I had was always great with him. So I got to put him in my first book. I have another one that's coming out probably within the next 6 months. Started a Kickstarter program. It actually got sidelined, but we're going to start it back up again. The next one is a Sasquatch for Dinner. It's kind of a sequel, same character, but we're about halfway through with that. And so hopefully within the next few weeks we'll have the Kickstarter program back up.
Cool. Do you have a website pluggy goodness or anything you want to...
Yes, website pluggy goodness is ronaldjrobledo.com.
Cool.
Yeah.
R-O-B-L-E-D-O.
That is correct. D as in David, yeah.
So cool. Well, there's that side. So, what was the? I mean, it was a long time in Imagineering. I mean, it. I guess we always have this perception, being on the outside, that it's, you know, I guess what we saw Silicon Valley with, you know, with all the, it was cool. It was a fun place to work. Positive energy. I mean, is it everything that, you know, is expected?
I would say so. I mean, after 14 years, I only have fond memories. Well, I met my wife there, so that was pretty incredible for me. But it was absolutely amazing. I enjoyed going to work every day. It's not one of those things that, dang, I got to get up and go to work. I would say that towards the end of it, it did kind of start to run its course. I was getting a little bit tired. I remember...
Well, 15 years is a chunk.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter where you're working. That's a chunk of time.
And I do remember thinking at one point in time, it's like, I don't know how much longer I can do this. I need something that's a little more fresh. And they said, hey, well, let me help you. And so after 14 years, I was shown the door. And then about 3 months later, they called me back. And at that time, I actually went to work for Consumer Products for a few years, which was something else altogether, being able to see that side of Disney.
Yeah, just different things.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But I learned a lot over there.
Yeah.
In fact, I still work with a lot of the Disney people in the current job that I have as a... Like you wear a lot of different hats as creative director for a company called Excel Outdoor. We design and manufacture outdoor sporting equipment, but I have to meet with the Disney people on a regular basis because, you know, we do Cars, Princess, we do Toy Story, and the likes. And now we're doing Marvel, so I still have to go over to my old stomping grounds, Flower Street in Glendale.
And now you'll have Star Wars.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting universe. You know, just when you think you know where all the pieces on the chessboard are, it all shifts.
And I'll tell you, like I said, I was getting a bit... it was getting a little bit stale for me, and some of my colleagues who are still there... maybe not. I saw somebody running. We're kind of saying the same thing, and now that they have Star Wars, that's a great shot in the arm for a lot of people who've been there for a number of years.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I think the same thing with Marvel. I mean, they really haven't started to tap that yet. Films has, but theme park hasn't seen, you know, the expansion of that they can have. I remember, we'll go back in time in our Wayback Machine. Remember the Universal Studios, the Marvel Cafe? They actually had Marvel characters as your waiters and waitresses serving you food. It was kind of where the ranch
Marvel
barbecue.
Mania? Was it Marvel
Mania? Marvel Mania, yeah.
Yeah. I went there for my birthday one year. I took my daughter, who was like maybe 5 or 6 years old, and a huge Captain America comes to my table, and my daughter's eating like a 7-pound hamburger, and he comes in and says, "You need to eat all that protein so you'll get big and strong." And I'm thinking, are you kidding? I mean, he was a musclehead. With all due respect, he played the part well. He looked like Captain America. But telling a kindergarten kid to eat a 7-pound burger.
Well, it's a guy. I remember Storm taking our drink order.
Oh, wow.
Like, oh, yeah. I mean, it was the most bizarre. Like, I was half expecting, you know, Wolverine to come out with Brazilian barbecue and cut you a piece of meat at the table. It was it was peculiar.
It was fun. I don't think it was done well, but
no, it was not done well. It was Planet Hollywood plastic, you know, memorabilia, low quality props on the walls and bad character and acting. And at that point, then that would have been mid-90s, early 90s. But yeah, they didn't have the resources behind the Marvel company we think of today. It was not the same animal. The big question is going to be: is what is Disney going to do about Sony and Fox owning so many of the other Marvel properties? Because I think it's got to, at some point, you got to wonder if they're going to pay the money to have it all brought under the same roof.
Hmm.
Because between Spider-Man, Fantastic Four, it's all got to live in the same house, because the villains right now are split. There are some villains that are tied into certain universes and certain, Doctor Doom is tied over at Fox because of Fantastic Four. So Avengers couldn't include that in the storyline.
Oh my gosh, that's insane.
So there's so many of these fragmented villain issues that you don't even know where they can go with. But no, I think it'd be, even if it's just an Indiana Jones-style ride through the Marvel Universe, as long as it's an Indiana Jones-style ride and not a superstar limo-style ride.
Oh my god! Oh yeah.
And over on our left, Dr. Octopus has got Maps to the Stars homes.
That was horrible. I remember some of the cardboard stand-ups they had in that.
Oh, it was
early on. That was horrible.
Yeah, that's one of those mark of shame. You know, and it's a great concept, and I understand why they would do that. But you know that the celebrities are going to be dated.
Oh, and they were dated before they even finished.
Oh yeah, that Jackie Chan.
Yeah.
I mean, it was not a. The Superstar Limo was not a pretty moment. I was glad when that went to Monsters Incorporated, and I think that ride absolutely supports the, and it was in 3D long before the movie's coming out in 3D. So I'm actually looking forward to they're re-releasing Monsters as a 3D.
Right.
Relatively before
soon, before the
Monsters University. Yeah. So. So here's an interesting question from the Imagineering perspective that I've... This is one that's been bouncing around, waiting to ask the right person. So Jungle has now hit 57, 58 years, whatever it is. Does Jungle Cruise make it to 100?
Wow.
Because from an Imagineering viewpoint, maybe you have a different take than the skipper side would.
I don't know if I can answer that truthfully because, you know, I work the attraction, so it's kind of like you don't bet with your heart.
Yeah,
I don't think I can answer that honestly. My heart says.
What's your discussion? I mean, just on the discussion side. I mean, I think that as one of the opening attractions, day one attractions, I don't think that a single day one attraction that's currently open today will ever close. I don't think that they'll let it happen.
I don't think they would. Yeah. It was kind of like originally when they wanted to close Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln and the backlash they got for that.
Yeah. Well, and that was a much later attraction. I mean, even the subs going away, you know, and the press for the subs to come back. You know, and granted, Nemo is not everyone's cup of tea, but I think they did a good job in theming it and, you know, working the ride. And unfortunately, it's a low-capacity ride.
Right.
You know, it's got a third of the capacity of Haunted Mansion.
Which was when they told me that they were rehabbing it, I was kind of surprised because I always thought the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, if you can only put 900 people an hour through that attraction, I don't know the actual number.
It is, it's 900.
I don't actually discuss things like that because, as I have learned, Disney Legal listens to every one of my podcasts.
Do they really?
That's what someone told me.
Wow.
So,
oh, I better.
There are certain things I just
edit this thing.
Yeah, I don't discuss like attraction capacity or how many people can go in the theme park or, you know, any of those fun, stupid things. So, but no, you know, Nemo, much smaller. You know, I remember 3 and 4 hour waits for that ride. And it's funny that you can really do any. They can bring back Inner Space, Mission to Inner Space, and they could have a 3 hour line for it for a while. Cars Land, I think, is going to have a long 80 minute lines will be the norm for that during the summer. Even with single rider or fast pass, I think your standby is always going to be hour and a half. It's a great attraction.
How often do you go to the parks?
You know, I probably am in 3 to 4 times a year, and I'm down at least once a month for podcast taping or hanging out with other skippers or whatever it is. We actually usually it's go to Trader Sam's and have alcohol is really the. You haven't been down to the resort since the bar opened.
No, I haven't been there.
And Trader Sam's is what we always dreamed of. It's a tiki bar. It's a tiki bar with relatively overpriced drinks. That seats the same number of people as a Jungle Cruise boat. The actual bar has a 48-person capacity.
Wow.
And then there's a huge patio seating area, and their food's pretty good, and it's a good place to hang out. It's got the Jungle Cruise feel to it, the sense of humor. They took a lot of the props and some things on the walls
from
the Adventurers Club in Orlando that closed, and you know different things. And they have a Skipper of the Year from the Jungle Cruise that gets their picture up in the attraction. Randy Grant has got his mug sitting right there on the wall right now. But yeah, they have a volcano that goes off when people order the volcano drink. And
was that something that Imagineer designed?
Oh, it's fully Imagineer designed. It's a full.
And how long has that been there?
it's over a year now. Because I know it opened up last summer before last. Because it was right when the podcast was coming online, and that was, you know, August of 2011, so.
Do they still use, complete sidebar, do they still use guns on the...
Oh, the guns are back. Yeah, the guns came back 2006. Like, from 03 to, or 02 to 06, or 02 to 05, the guns were gone, and they had air horns for the emergency signals. But yeah, no, the guns were gone for a while. There's a lot of, you know, I guess we haven't really talked about this because we haven't had anyone from the generation right when they were losing the guns. For those listeners who don't know the story, there's a group called People for the Ethical Treatment of Animatronics, PETA, that were afraid that we were firing fake guns at fake animals on a fake river, that we might damage the breeding patterns of the ecological... No, that's actually... PETA had nothing to do with it. There were various reasons that went into the whole gun thing, and you know, luckily, I think it brings something for them to have it back. I think it was the culture of the early 90s.
Were you there when they used to actually fire at the
At the animals?
Yeah.
You know what? I think so. It's not supposed to. It's supposed to be shots in the air to scare them away.
Right.
And it's actually more of a practical issue of if you have the gun too close to the ear line of a small child. You know, there was, when I was training with the guns, it was my third time at the resort, my second time on Jungle. And I'm not going to name names, but someone did a very graphic and fantastic demonstration. They took a hot dog from the in-between and put it about an inch away from the end of the gun. And they fired the gun, and that hot dog, even with as a blank, the hot dog just disintegrated. And it was one of the best examples of why you don't pull a John Eric Hexum. Don't know if you'd recognize it. There was a TV show called Voyagers in the 80s.
Oh my gosh! Okay.
With the jumpers where they had the blanks, time travel,
yeah.
And he was playing around with a blank gun and had it too close to his head, and a fragment of the shell casing went into his head and killed him on the spot.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, it's the.
Well,
the
rumor does have that actually did happen to a couple of the Jungle Cruise skippers, but. No one noticed.
They blew their brains out and there wasn't much there. We should clarify, for legal, this is what's classified in the jungle as a joke. For those of you who may not have ridden the Jungle Cruise, or maybe for those of you who have, a joke is for humorous intent. Yeah, there were some skippers. That's, you know, I think every generation has their standouts. And then every generation has the people who just don't get it. You know, because it's a ride that's driven by talent or lack thereof.
Yeah.
You know, everyone knows that, you know, your jungle experience is based on whether you have a good skipper or a bad skipper.
It's interesting. I remember, like I said, I was in my early 20s, maybe my mid-20s when I was there. Even a lot of the cast members, they you could tell the ones that were there to help people with, you know, as I said earlier, you know, Disney making the magic. Except for, I used to share a locker right next to, it was like an old cook. An old chef, but he used to do these amazing impressions, mm-hmm. and he the old Bogart impressions. And you know, I'd go there, and we would like always end up at this quitting at the same time,
getting off at the same time. Yeah.
Oh, but it was interesting with him because he would do those jokes, and I remember asking him one time, why don't you do voiceovers? He was pretty good for an old guy. Mm-hmm. But he wasn't one of the happy cast members. He's a really bitter old guy. Like, no, they'll never help you here. It's like, you know, you could just call casting and just put your foot out there. Just give it a shot. Yeah. And he was just so negative about it. I remember thinking, you have nothing to lose. This is Disney. This is... it never gave it a shot. It was kind of a shame. And the funny thing is, I actually remember, I still think about it to this day, where if I want to try something, it's like, I don't want to be like that 60-something-year-old crabby guy who mm-hmm. didn't want to take a shot.
Yeah.
You were talking about firing the guns as well. That's another wonderful, fond memory when you first get to Disneyland and you're hearing those shots being fired.
You know, it's still, I will say, if I'm out on the Esplanade outside the park and I hear two shots ringing out, or six, God forbid, you know, it still catches a little bit. There's still that little bit of me that when I hear it, I get a little... you know, sentimental for, you know, it's been 4 years now since I've left, 4 or 5 years, and I still get a little sentimental when I hear the guns. You know, talking about the attitude making the magic thing, I should plug this other podcast. A week or two ago I recorded with a podcast, actually by the time this airs, who knows how long it'll be, a podcast called The Sweep Spot, SWEEP, and it's a couple of custodial members who do a podcast, and they've interviewed some great people. And then they interviewed me, and they blew the curve. I had a great sit-down with the guys over there, and we were talking about how every single person is responsible and can make the magic, and how, you know, people may, you know, look down their nose at custodial, or they may look down their nose at whatever foods, but every single person is doing something in that regard. So
I absolutely agree.
Yeah, and it's all attitude. It's all how you want to bring the attitude to the table.
One of the wonderful many hats that I wore over at Imagineering was taking film, scanning it, cleaning it up, and old images of Walt. And one of them, a great one, is him walking down Main Street, bending over and picking up a piece of trash.
Yep.
Absolutely. Yeah, you help make that guest experience. I think the last time I was there a few years ago, I don't think a lot of them get it nowadays. And I don't know if it's the generation now or what's going on, but it's kind of a shame.
Well, I think that's everyone, though. I think that every generation looks at the way we've... You know, it's so funny. I think that every single person who's been on the podcast has at some point said basically what you just said, which is that, you know, there's a perception issue, whatever, that the people who are there now, whatever it is. And we've really come to the conclusion that, you know, every generation has its magic. You know, you'll never have a summer like the summer you're at Jungle.
Right.
And every person should have it. Everyone should have that one magic summer. But, you know, as things change and as things move on, it's always going to be different. It isn't better or worse. The people that I meet there today, there's the same mix of people who have absolute apathy, and they're there because it's a job.
Right.
And you've got the people that are there because they want to make magic. And the people that are there because they want to make magic, I think it's probably the same proportions. I think, you know, maybe it's gone down since, like, the 60s. But I can't imagine you didn't have people who, even in the, you know, the park open, weren't there just to pull a paycheck.
And I think...
Because the cult of celebrity wasn't the way it was. Walt may have been one of the few real celebrities. I mean, the big people that people would get, you know, sentimental because of his role with television. But I'm sure there are people there who are just cashing a paycheck.
And I kind of felt the same way about some of the my coworkers over at Imagineering, to be completely honest. There are other people that absolutely knew that they were there to make that guest experience magic.
Oh, sure. Sure.
And then others, not so much.
Yeah. Now, outside of the Jungle Cruise, because we have to take this out of the question because it's unfair, because we all know that the Jungle Cruise is the best ride that they have at the parks, hands down. There's nothing even close to it.
The Swiss Family Robinson Treehouse was a very close second.
You know, that's facetiousness. Doesn't translate. No, yeah, Swiss Family Robinson. I miss the treehouse.
I used to hate being on that treehouse when, like, no, we need you over here. And again, it was my second job, so there are times I would take a book with me and I would put it inside the drawer so I would read as I'm supposed to be. You know, nobody went on that attraction. I remember I would use the same line when somebody would, usually kids, teenagers, hey, what is this attraction? You've never heard of this? The Haunted Swiss Family Robinson Treehouse? What? And so they would come back down very, yeah, that was bad. That was just wrong. And they weren't very happy when they came down.
Now, was Tiki was a separate attraction when you were there?
Yeah.
Yeah, because it was separate training, and they had the shirts and the whole deal. Yeah. They hadn't blended that together with Jungle. We knew both.
The Polynesian Terrace?
Yeah, the Tahitian Terrace.
The Tahitian?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was there. I remember that wonderful, you would, the joke, it's beautiful, it's majestic, it's the backside of water, right, mm-hmm. when you go under the fall. And then if you're going by the terrace and the
Trader Sam.
The dancers were there, right, mm-hmm. doing yep. their little hula, you kind of throw the same. I didn't use very many jokes that weren't standard operating procedures, but one of them was, it's beautiful, it's majestic, it's the backside of, you know, when the girls were there. And I would just leave it at that, dot, dot, dot.
Yeah, well, because I would agree when those things are there. Yeah, it's a big wall now, just a wall that blocks it off. So that was open when you came in.
Yeah.
You would actually see the dancers and all that.
Yeah.
That's a great joke. That works very well there. Yeah, they did a one night only return thing with the Tahitian Terrace. I might even be this December. It might be coming up, but it was like $1,200, and you get to have the actual menu, or $600, whatever it was. It's ridiculously high price. But they were recreating it with actual dancers and recreating with the actual food that the terrace had for a one-night-only experience.
Wow.
Which is just crazy outrageous, which you almost kind of go, if that's special to someone, they're going to pay it.
Yeah. And you said it's possibly, well, December?
I think it might be coming up. I think it might be, and it may not be that expensive. It may not be.
And even if it is, my guess is, you know, it's already sold out.
Yeah, it's
there are just so many people. And again, I have a lot of family members who will buy the yearly pass, and they'll go every week, every couple of weeks, and other friends will ask, how is it that people can go to the park that often? It's like, you know.
Well, you know, I had an AP for a while, and me and my ex-wife would just go in for lunch. We'd just go in to shop or something and do one or two rides, and it actually took a lot of stress off being there for the whole day.
Hmm.
But at the time, you know, it was, you know, 2099 in that ballpark before DCA opened, and there was still such a thing as an off-season.
Right.
You know, now, I don't, you know, it's a tough balance. Having an annual passport is the only really affordable way to see the parks for Southern California. But the park is so busy year round that there's, you know, there's no good time to come.
I would do the same thing with my daughter, where we go once every month, or once every couple of months.
Sure.
When she was in elementary school, we'd get there right when it was opening. We would hit all the rides that she wants to hit. We'd have lunch and then take off.
Yeah, and that's the annual passport. If it wasn't for the APs, you know, a lot of the cast members get really, you know, grumpy about it. Without that money coming into the resort, it wouldn't have, you know, been at the level it's at now. You know, they needed to fill those off-season days for the park to succeed. I mean, that was really, you know, the tough reality of it. And it worked. It worked extremely well. So any other great Disney memories? Anything you want to throw into our annals of recorded history?
Like I said, working at Imagineering was great. You know, I loved Disneyland. It's magic.
Yeah, and no matter how much time you spend backstage, I mean, some people are going to be jaded, and that's just their personality.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that. I remember the first time that I got to go backstage with Chris. Is he here?
No, he's
here. Hey, here he comes.
No, actually, he's done. The traffic was too bad on the freeway, so we'll catch up with him at a different time.
being backstage and seeing some of the characters taking their heads off was eye-opening.
Yeah.
That was...
I remember my first day of training in 2000. We were back at the In Between, the Cast Cafe,
mm-hmm.
and our training group was there, and I saw an Alice in Wonderland, come backstage. And she lifted up her skirt from the front, and from one garter she pulled out a Zippo, and from the other garter she pulled out a pack of smokes. And now you would never have a character smoking in costume, and I don't even know at the time. But I kind of looked at that as my Disney virginity being going away, that was my moment that I went, oh, yeah, I'm backstage now. It changed things. Yeah. You know, that perception of where you're at with that really changes the whole song and dance. But it's, I mean, yeah, it's good. And it's what you make of it. You know, it isn't, you don't get this card that says instant magic. You know, just add water. You've got to work it.
Right. Well, so. You're talking from a guest perspective?
No, from a cast member perspective. Okay. You know, you don't just instantly come into it and you're not instantly happy. You've got to make that choice every day to come to work and have that perception.
I think for me, when I first, like I said, started there before Imagineering, I think it was that way for me. I think the pixie dust fell off after a few months of, you know, doing that boat around
40 times a day.
But I think the pixie dust dropped off from time to time. But even working at Imagineering, like I said, for the amount of time that I did, the pixie dust would definitely drop off. But being able to go back to the park and watch the reaction that the guests would have, it brought it right back. It's kind of like, okay, I see that. Now it's time to go back to work and work towards helping to get that sort of reaction.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think I reiterate this every 5 or 6 episodes for people who are just joining the podcast. We started doing this because there was a gap. There was the experience that guests had on stage when they got to see the rides. There was an experience that they got from reading the internet and from reading books on the subject and seeing the backstage magic. But what there wasn't was a definitive oral history of what it was like to work there. And granted, the slice we're doing is mainly the Jungle Cruise slice,
right.
But we've had people on from other attractions. I really try to keep it jungle focused, and it's interesting because the episodes we do are about a 50-50 split of us sitting down like we have tonight and really kind of getting into the depth of it. I mean, this is more of a meat and potatoes kind of episode. And then we just have it where a bunch of skippers are screwing around and telling dirty jokes and telling some of the history still. But we do it with the filters off. And, you know, at the root of it, I think, you know, Jungle Cruise skippers, people who've worked it, tend to be, the first people who'll pull out a dirty joke at a party. And that's fine, and that's, you know, that's kind of what we try to represent is both sides of it, both the magic side of it, and, you know, and from the Imagineering side and all that. It's nice to have, you know, that perspective as well. But it's nice to have the balance. I mean, I don't want the podcast to be entirely blue, but there's times where, you know, it's fun just to kick back and, you know, shoot the shit, and, you know, and joke about the things that happen and, you know, the things that aren't, you know, as kid friendly. And then there's times we want to, you know, be serious and talk about what it's like to work there, because it is still, I will say this, anyone who's getting out of high school, before you go to college, unless you know with 100% assuredness what you want to do with your life, stop, go work at Disney for 6 months. It's the single most life-changing experience that you'll have outside of maybe the Peace Corps. Because it teaches, you know, multiculturalism. I've seen in 6 weeks people having their bigotry and homophobia stripped away from them. People coming in with the most hardcore beliefs that, you know, some people are better than others, and whatever that sounds like. And 6 weeks, every perception they've had has changed, because they've never had an eye-opening worldview shift the way that you get when you work at Disney. And everything changes. Working in a corporate business environment, working under union rules, working under, I mean, everything that you do. But most importantly, having a blank ticket to make magic for people on a minute-by-minute basis. There's nowhere else you can have that. There's nothing else that will prepare you better for life, and there's nothing that will give you the friendships that will last a lifetime. It's like high school meets, you know, this magical opportunity to change people's lives.
Yeah, I still use a lot of what I learned there as far as my interaction skills with people that I run into, that I meet. That's another wonderful aspect of it. I mean, if somebody's going to ask me for direction, hey, where's the coffee bean and tea leaf?
You're still giving two fingers?
Oh, or an open hand, yeah.
Yep. There's a few times I want to give them an open hand right on the back of the... But yeah, no, it's... it's a life change. It's a game changing opportunity, and I think everyone should, take that and run with it and have that experience, because, we were figuring the math. Let's say that you had 55 years the park was open, and let's say that maybe on Jungle you had 40 or 50 people a year trained to do that ride. So there's been maybe 2,500, 3,000 skippers. Maybe the number's higher than that. And then when you include, Orlando and, Hong Kong and all, but let's just say conservatively that there's been 5,000 skippers or 5,500 skippers, whatever that number is. You're one of 5,000 people that's carried on Walt's legacy. Hmm. And, where else can you say that you have, done something that is as significant and that's recognized? People still, if I say I'm a Jungle Cruise skipper, there's an instant look of respect in their eyes. If only they knew everything else about me that would take that respect immediately away. But it is definitely that singular experience that not a lot of people get to have.
That's still part of my bio. When somebody needs my bio for whatever reason, even on my website, former Imagineer, professor at Art Center College of Design, creative director, executive member of the History Museum, and most importantly, Jungle Cruise skipper.
Absolutely. So cool. Well, we'll leave it on that note. Ron, thanks for coming and sitting down. And next time, we'll try to get Chris involved at some point. I'll fill in the blanks in case I edit this later. But the third person who was going to be sitting with us was caught in lovely Los Angeles traffic and was not able to join us. So it was just a two-person show tonight. But I appreciate your comment. Even though we're only rolling out an episode every 3 weeks or 4 weeks, we still keep on growing our audience. There are some days that 200, 300, listeners hit our podcast. So it surprises me, and I love the support. And, just to give the plugs, if you guys want to give any input or feedback, I haven't asked for this for a while. We love to hear your opinions and what you think of the podcast. The email address is junglecrews, C-R-E-W-S, @gmail.com. You can find us over on Facebook at facebook.com/junglecrews, C-R-E-W-S. You can find us on iTunes by searching Skipcast. You'll also find our sister podcast, Nerd 101, over there. We do the Jungle Cruise radio plays. And, of course, our good friends Joey and Trevor at Joey and Trevor Talk to Each Other on Podbean or on iTunes. And Joey and Trev are amazing cats, and their podcast just keeps on getting better and better. So check it out, guys. I appreciate your coming and sitting down with us. We'll see you guys in the boathouse, and happy hearty Kungaloosh, and happy holidays to all of you. Thanks for supporting us now for over a year.